You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Timothy Ryback has served as the director for the Institute of Historical Justice and Reconciliation in The Hague, the deputy secretary general for the Académie Diplomatique Internationale in Paris, the vice president and resident director of the Salzburg Global Seminar in Salzburg, and lecturer in the Concentration of History and Literature at Harvard. He's also the author of The Last Survivor, Hitler's Private Library, and Hitler's First Victims. His new book is Takeover, Hitler's Final Rise to Power. Thank you for joining me, Tim.
It's great to be here, Rick. Thank you.
When we hear the name Hitler these days, pictures immediately come to mind. You know, the man standing in black and white pictures in front of crowds screaming and, you know, being cheered on. We think of the concentration camps. We think maybe of, you know, the many battles that were won. And we think of him, you know, as the absolute dictator and in many ways, you know, the most evil man to be documented in history. What we don't think of is how he came to power. And your book, Takeover, tells this story and focuses on this story. It's an incredible narrative because it was written here in the 21st century. It reads like a 21st century thriller. It's page turning. What we see is the story of a man who decided to use the tools of democracy to dismantle democracy and did so against many odds. So talk about finding this particular story within the larger arc of the rise and fall of the Third Reich. I think of course, you do as well, as of Shirer's amazing book. So talk about finding this incredible page-turning tale of terror such a big quilt.
Well, Rick, I guess Takeover, it is about how Hitler sort of his final rise to power, but the book itself is about how Hitler almost didn't come to power.
Exactly. yeah, we think about that. One of the things I thought about as I was reading it, that this book is very much a story of what ifs.
Absolutely. And I mean, you'd mentioned the endpoints of everything we know about Hitler. Without question, the most evil human force of the 20th century, possibly of all time, the ultimate endpoint being the Holocaust, the extermination of 6 million Jewish men, women, and children, and 60 million Europeans across the continent. Okay. And what we tend to do as historians is to explain how this happened and what it is. So in order to explain it, you look at all of those pieces that led to him coming to power. But through that process, what we do is eliminate necessarily all of the alternatives about how it almost didn't happen. And what this, and you know, historians' job is to tell us how we got from where we were to where we are. And that's the job of the historian. But as I say, it leaves a lot of information out. And so what I decided to do in writing this book is to forget everything I knew and to start to track Hitler in the last 6 months before his rise to power, from August 1932 until 11 o'clock in the morning on January 30th, 1933, when he became chancellor, and simply followed the day-by-day development of events in the newspapers, using diaries, using meeting protocols, but without any hindsight at all, and you get a completely different story, a completely different narrative around this man. So that's why, if it does, it is a different way of telling that story and that history. With that said, William Shire, it's a shared love. He's one of the great, not only historians, but one of the great storytellers of the, of the 20th century of all time, really capturing that. The book was written in the 1950s. It still feels vital and important today. Yeah, it's.
I'm actually currently rereading him, and I had just finished the part where he covers this, and I was thinking, boy, that's really interesting. I never knew that, but I think your approach, as you say, to forget everything you know going in is why this book has such an urgency to it. Because Hitler wasn't, I mean, Hitler was somewhat lazy, probably crazy. And not friendly, not even politically friendly to Germany, that at the time was, in dire straits financially, socially. That after World War I, they were in a lot of trouble. So his rise to power is not expected, and I think you do a great job of showing just how he kind of came through that slot machine, just back and forth and whacked here and whacked there, and then finally hit the jackpot, so to speak. So talk about, I love the way you create the characters in this book. I mean, Paul von Hindenburg is, even you kind of like all these guys, and I found myself in the final parts of this book thinking, well, how is Hitler going to get out of this? He's put himself really in a bad straitjacket. I'm thinking, wait, I'm rooting for Adolf Hitler. This is bad.
It's as you mentioned, Hindenburg was his great opponent. What did it, you need to keep in mind, Hindenburg was president of the Weimar Republic. He represented the state and the nation. Adolf Hitler was a chancellor who ran the government. And what it is, the president had the power to appoint or dismiss a chancellor. And so the president's job was to sit above the fray, watch everything that's going on. And the chancellor's job was to run the day-to-day affairs of the country. If the president didn't like what was going on, he had Article 53 of the Constitution gave him the power to appoint or dismiss a chancellor at will. And he had that power, and he exercised that power regularly. In the 8 months before he appointed Hitler chancellor, he had dismissed three previous chancellors, and there was nothing preventing him from doing the same with Hitler. And that was a great hope for a lot of people. But as you say, with Hindenburg, his relationship with Hitler, he famously referred to him as that Bohemian corporal. When Hitler first approached him in August of 1932 about assuming the chancellorship, Hindenburg told him to his face, he said, "I will not appoint you chancellor for the sake of God, my conscience, and the country." It's just, there was no way. And as you said, you watch in the course of the 6 months, Hitler keeps, trying to position himself to get away. Hindenburg keeps swatting him away. And then suddenly we arrive at January of 33. And what's astonishing there is that in those 6 months, Hitler had basically bankrupted the Nazi Party. There had been six election cycles that they'd gone through. They had drained the coffer. They were somewhere between 30 and 90 million Reichsmarks in debt. In today's, that's hundreds of millions of dollars in debt. They were hemorrhaging membership. They'd lost 2 million votes in the last election, and there was divisions within the party. People were, the party was being pulled apart internally. So, the Nazi movement and Hitler, it was basically by January of 33, it was bankrupt economic, financially, politically, and even ideologically. And then we have this 2 week period where things suddenly change. And Hindenburg, at the last minute, agrees to appoint Hitler chancellor and basically saves Hitler's political career at that point, because the Nazi movement, had Hitler not come to power at that particular moment, he never would have, because, as I say, the Nazi Party was, it wasn't dissolving, but it was in a retrenchment. The German economy was actually recovering. So the crisis that Hitler was riding on with his popularity and in the elections, those issues were falling away. So that by January, Hitler had very few cards to play. But the man had the luck of the devil, and there was, as I say, a lot of backroom deals going on. And Hindenburg agreed to appoint Hitler on one condition, which was that I never be left alone in a room with that Bohemian corporal.
One of the things I loved about this book were the was that we think when we think about Hitler, we think about killing, about violence, we think about the SS. There was not a lot of that in this book. This book is really about hardball politics, which Hitler played. I mean, Hitler said, I will not allow myself to be named vice chancellor or chancellor unless I have absolute dictatorial power over the entire country from day one. But he was the head of the Nazi Party, and there were other factions, as you talk about. The biggest one was named by a man who's called himself a Hitler man, Georg Strasser. And also added into this mix was a place called the Brown House. This is where the Nazis convened and did all their planning. And what had happens very early on in the book is that there is a mole in the Brown House. And the mole conveys a lot of confidential information to one of my favorite characters in this book. And it's hard to call anybody a favorite because they're all vicious, awful human beings. Schleicher, which is Schleichen is a German word for creep. So Schleicher lived up to his name. So talk about the who Schleicher was, because he was really important. And as I read the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, the Schreiber book, I was thinking, boy, Schleicher, I had never heard this name, but he seems like he's somebody. But I think one of the things your book does is, A, it puts everything in kind of contemporaneous mode so that none of the characters know how this is going to turn out, so that the reader, you do a good job of making the reader, if not forget, to wonder, well, I know how this is going to turn out, but I have no idea how it's going to get there. So talk about Strasser and Schleicher and creating this kind of rivalry between Strasser, Schleicher, Hindenburg, and Hitler, who are this quartet of people, presiding over what will be the end of the 20th century.
Well, let's start with Kurt von Schleicher. He was a general in a three-piece suit. He was more when they, there's a famous von Clausewitz phrase that war is politics by other means. With Schleicher is exactly the opposite. Politics was war by other means. And what he did, there was a big New York Times feature on Schleicher in the spring of 1932. This is New York Times Sunday news, maybe the Sunday magazine did this feature on him. And they said, if there's anything in politics that's going on in Germany which seems inexplicable, it can all be traced back to Kurt von Schleicher. And this was simply a man, as you mentioned, Schleichen is to creep, but Schleicher had been head of military intelligence, which meant he had this network of spies throughout the entire country, but then, and then positioned himself as sort of a protege of Hindenburg, and played that well. He fit very well into, Hindenburg's closest circle. Hindenburg basically trusted Schleicher, assumed that whatever was okay with Schleicher ultimately was okay with Hindenburg. So Schleicher had his way about things and was the ultimate power broker. There are these people who are power brokers in Washington, who are real insiders. Well, Schleicher was one of those on the German scene, and was, I'll put the guy pulling the strings behind the scenes. And all of this will come together. The second guy that you'd mentioned is Gregor Strasser, who has almost been erased from history because Hitler erased him from history. And what Gregor Strasser was, he was one of the early members of the Nazi Party. Now, when you would talk to people in Germany at the time, there was Hitler, but there was also Strasser. They were yin and yang. Hitler was the movement was called the German, they were called the National Socialists, which means there was this hyper-nationalism, but there's also the socialism, the commitment to the working class. It was called the Workers' Party. Well, Hitler was the nationalist. Strasser was the real socialist. And together they sort of gave truth to this term, the National Socialist Movement. Hitler also came, for you have to understand sort of the demographics of Germany. The Southern Germans are really a very different type of person from the Northern Germans. The Northern Germans tend to be a bit cooler, a bit calmer. And a lot of them did not understand this hothead Hitler. Strasser was a much cooler figure. And basically, the two men had divided up the country. Strasser ran the northern part of the country, and hothead Hitler was in the south. And the two of them eventually came into conflict. As you mentioned, Hitler would never, everything he did was to double down. He never backed off. He never admitted defeat. When they lost these 2 million votes in the November 32 election, Strauss said, oh my God, we're hemorrhaging votes, we're hemorrhaging memberships, we're bankrupt. Hitler said, no, he isn't. This told us who our real loyalists are, and we will continue like this. And that's where the conflict came, because Strasser said, you're driving the party into ruin. We need to enter into a coalition with, actually, at that time, Schleicher was chancellor of the country. So Strasser basically said, look, we need to partner with Schleicher, set up a conservative government, get ourselves a foot in the door. And Hitler simply wouldn't have it. And the two men split over this, and it almost destroyed the Nazi Party. But what happened was Hitler, with this internal triumph, with this internal struggle, Hitler ultimately triumphed, sidelined Strasser, then went behind Schleicher's back and basically out-Schleichered Schleicher. And he basically brought him down. All of this taking place around Hindenburg, because Hindenburg is the kingmaker. I mean, Hindenburg sits there. He's this 84-year-old man. He's a great war hero. He's this towering figure over 6 foot. I mean,
exactly. He used his physical presence to intimidate people. He was smart.
He was a walking monument, and he was simply the most popular political figure, war hero in the country. He was an icon. So, you know, he ultimately was the kingmaker. Well, you had all this going around, as you'd mentioned. You know, you had Schleicher as chancellor. You had Hitler and Strasse fighting over what the Nazi Party should be. And ultimately, Hitler sidelined Strasse and then undermined Schleicher. And suddenly, he was the last man standing. And Hindenburg had no other choice but to say, I've got to appoint this guy chancellor. I'll do it. But with the guarantee that I never be left alone in a room with that man. And that's how it happened.
You mentioned the New York Times coverage of Schleicher. And the New York Times, and there's a reporter whose name escapes me at the moment, in particular, are kind of characters in this, in that they don't get it right, very right. The Times coverage indicates that the Times themselves and Americans in general really had no clue and didn't really actually care what was going on in Germany all that much. So talk about, you know, one of the things I love about this book is your ability to put details where you have them, and also your ability to write your way around the places where you don't have details. And you say, we don't know what these guys said to each other in this room. And I think that you do that really well. The narrative components of this book are just really particularly amazing in your ability to generate this page-turning suspense over events that took place, you know, almost 100 years ago, and you know, we all know how it turned out. But as you said, and I just I was beginning to suss this. I was thinking, this is kind of a book of what ifs. What if Strasser had been more successful? You know, would we have had a really different world? So talk about using the details, like the New York Times and others, to create this kind of page-turning suspense, and also finding them and knowing when to use them and when to throw them away. I mean, I imagine there might be 6 books this thick, and this is fairly thin, lying somewhere piled in pages in one of these many spare rooms in your house.
Well, let me say, the whole idea to this book came from a New York Times headline from January of 1933, which was, Hitler gives up aim to make himself dictator, basically. And here, this is a New York Times headline, and this is when Hitler agrees to become chancellor, because he entered into a lot of compromises. As you said, this is a guy who never backed down. He always doubled down, and suddenly he made some compromises. He wanted to be dictator on day one. He wanted to walk in and on his terms, and he was not allowed to. And suddenly there were all these compromises. Some said, oh, so Hitler has suddenly, you know, given up his claim to dictatorship, and we see that in the headline. You know, newspapers are called the first draft of history. That's what journalists, and we don't focus on headlines like that because we know history turned out differently. And so that sort of gets filtered out of the stories that get told when historians begin going through this. My other favorite New York Times article, and this is really unbelievable. This is going a couple of months further, but when the Dachau concentration camp was set up, this was the first Nazi concentration camp. There's this phrase that, the trail of blood that began in Dachau ended in Auschwitz. So this is really where this is the epicenter of horror. The New York Times, 3 weeks after the Dachau concentration camp is set up, the New York Times is invited as the first foreign news organization to take a tour of the camp. And you can read this. It's an astonishing account because there are no, you don't have the watchtowers yet. What you have is a lot of barbed wire. You have guys with shaved heads and dungarees walking around. But the interesting thing is, it's the camp commandant, a guy named Vekela, who's one of the most vicious SS officers you can imagine. The classic guy with the whip and the attack dog and the peaked black hat. That was Vekela, blonde-haired, blue-eyed. When you read the New York Times piece, the correspondent says it's this charming, young, blonde-haired, blue-eyed officer, who's fairly witty, and he took me around the camp, and showed me around, and there were these the groups of people standing there. A lot of them looked pretty unhappy, but in fact, they were fairly well-fed, and this is the most astonishing line. And in fact, a lot of the people in this camp look as it looks as though society is better off with them in Dachau than on the outside. And you just read this thing and say, this is the New York Times writing about a Nazi concentration camp. It clearly doesn't fit with the narrative that we know, but it's also, it's a first draft of history. And you see this again and again. The other example I would quick, and this is to mine was the most one of the most surprising. I read the entire spectrum of the press. This is from the hard right, Völkische Beobachter. This is the Nazi newspaper. They're the most vicious anti-Semitism, anti-democratic, press you could have. And I went to the far left. I was reading Die Rote Fahne, with the Red Banner, which was the communist newspaper, and then all the newspapers in between, and you get the whole spectrum there. But as you're reading this, you're getting completely different versions or accounts of the same thing. But the most interesting thing on the left, the center and left press, was how much fun they made of Hitler. They were constant cartoons showing Hitler in absurd situations. I'm not going to describe it to you, but in the book, there's what was called, what one newspaper called Hitler's Unterhose Szene, Hitler's underwear scene, in which Hitler was literally caught with his pants down, and it made it into the press. Once again, this is not part of the story we know, but they ridiculed Hitler, they mocked him, they really had a good time, sold a lot of newspapers too, making fun of him. But just before Hitler came to power, he said, and I found this one of the most interesting statements, because you watch this guy and you go, how could anybody put up with this much ridicule and mockery and embarrassment? And he just puts up with this. But at one point he says, for the last 12 years, people have mocked and ridiculed me. Nobody is laughing now. And I find it's a very chilling statement, but it was Hitler was aware of what he would the kind of public abuse he was going through, how he was viewed. And keep in mind, this guy wasn't even German. He was an Austrian. Who came to Germany as basically was living as a stateless person. And it was only a year before he became chancellor, less than a year, that Hitler actually got German citizenship. So this was a guy that you could really have a lot of fun with. But at the end of the day, after January 30th, 1933, it wasn't funny anymore. And he vowed retribution. And he exacted it to a horrific degree. Maybe the other thing I could, oh, sorry, okay, go ahead. Right, sorry.
You are writing this book in 2025. And I have to say that as I'm reading this, when Hitler says, and he says this more than once, "I am the only one who can solve your problems." Or when Hitler is, as he was, confronted with photographs of himself meeting with Papen, the chancellor at the time, who was his avowed enemy that he swore he'd never be in a room with him, but he was making secret deals, trying to make secret deals with Papen. And they had photographs of this, and he said it didn't happen. They had photographs of him, and he said it didn't happen. So he was willing to lie in the face of incontrovertible evidence. The phrase "double down" really is a description of the way he operated for most of the time of this book. He was offered multiple opportunities to take smaller positions in power, and he turned them down. He said, "I will not be. I will not take power unless I can be chancellor, and in which I have absolute dictatorial power from day one over everything and every part of this government. And that's the only way I can help," quote, "help the German people." So as we read this in 2025, we take our own lessons, you know, rather seriously, you know. So talk about, I mean, just even as you are writing this, did this not send chills through your spine? And not about what was happening then, but what could happen now. I mean, it's over 100 years. Technology, society has changed immensely. Politics, not so much.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think there are a lot of resonances with a lot of the dynamics that were going on there.
As you say, you quote in at the end of the book, you quote the famous quote, "History does not repeat, but it rhymes, it echoes."
Yeah, the events of history rhyme, yeah. I think the most interesting thing about Hitler, I mean, not interesting, what I found rather astonishing, I read way too many Hitler speeches. I've read more Hitler speeches than you would ever want to read. But there are two, and they're the transcripts of them, because they were always published. And there are actually some audio recordings as well. Two things. One is that Hitler was a pretty funny guy, and it's surprising. But when you're reading these transcripts of his speeches, you'll see in their laughter, heightened laughter, storms of laughter. And most of his humor is mockery. I mean, he's making fun of political opponents. He's making fun of the political system. But his rallies were actually pretty funny events. And Hitler knew how to read a crowd. He knew how to manipulate a crowd. Something else, looking at the speeches, and you may have noticed this in the book, which is unusual for a book about Hitler, there's not a lot of talk about anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I did notice that, and I think it was fascinating, because, I mean, It helped to explain how he managed to make it through the chute, as it were.
What he did was, and this is where, frankly, the Social Democratic Party failed. Let me set that aside for a second. What Hitler talked about was to actually quote, I think it was James Carville, who basically in Clinton's first campaign, remember, it's the economy, stupid. It was, when you look at Hitler's speeches, he's talking about inflation. He's talking about war reparation payments. He's talking about unemployment. He's not talking about Jewish conspiracies. Now, there is anti-Semitism was built into the DNA of the Nazi Party. But when he was going out to voters and trying to court the public, that was actually set aside. And it really was the economy, stupid. And it was, you know, as you mentioned, you know, he said, I'm the only one. This thing is broken. I'm the only one who can fix it. And you see the focus on the key issues as he's in the run up to that election. It's grievance politics, but it's also getting to the point where the concerns are really there. And when you talk about the resonances, this is interesting. There was one thing that Hitler did was to one of his early acts as chancellor was to revoke the citizenship of Germany's most eminent statistician, a guy named Emil Gumbel. And Emil Gumbel was a colleague of Albert Einstein. You know, Einstein did the physics. Gumbel did the math and the numbers, and he was a very famous statistician. He was a social democrat. But after Hitler came to power, and after Gumbel was basically thrown out of the country and then stripped of his citizenship, but Gumbel was looking at and saying, what did we do wrong? You know, we were the social Democrats. The working people were our people. We were there to serve them. They were our base. How is it that all the young people went to the Nazis? How was it that all the workers went to the Nazis? What did we do wrong? And his analysis, and this is simply Germany's leading statistician, basically said Hitler was addressed. We were so caught up in ideals of democracy and representation and all the higher ideals of freedom and liberty that we forgot about what he called the Alltagssorgen, which were the everyday worries of the man. And we forgot about those. And so instead of the workers going to the socialists, the Democrats, they go to the far right extremists, the fascists. And, you know, Gumbel's assessment, and in some ways, you know, when you talk about resonances, I think, you know, the Democratic Party is sitting there going, you know, what went wrong? What happened? When you read Gumbel's assessment of it, it's the same kind of soul searching. What do we do now with it? Only the difference was there. By then, there was no now. And you know, Gumbel had lost his citizenship, had lost his country. That was that. The point is there are all kinds of resonances between that time and present. And this is where I would actually add something else, Rick, and then let you ask another question. But I think one of the what really struck me was the polarization of the news and the media landscape, almost identical to what you have today. You can take the same incident and you read it from different You read it in the far right in the Nazi paper, you get a completely different version of it as you do in the communists or in the central press. And you kind of, everybody takes the piece of that kind of serves their interest, but really the center falls away because the news information even becomes so polarized. And there was a flood, and you see the newspapers complain about this. There was a flood of what they called combinations or fabrications, which what we now call fake news. The media landscape was flooded with fake news. People were trying to pull apart. And one of the big right-wing conspiracy theories at the time, this is, you go, you're reading this, it's taking up a quarter page or, a third of a page of a major newspaper. What the right wing was claiming was that, they were against the Treaty of Versailles. This was the treaty that ended, there was the armistice that ended World War I, and then the Treaty of Versailles sort of, closed things off. And it did two things. One is it said that Germany was responsible for the entire war. It was this war guilt clause, which really was not fair. It also burdened them with immense reparations. They had to pay back billions to cover everybody's debt for the war. Also, when historians looking back now, this really was a draconian peace. It was not a peace treaty. It was a peace to end all peace. Because this is sort of what fed the disgruntlement and the economic distress of Germany at the time. But one of the pieces of fake news that was making the rounds was that the German government, in order to service this debt, was enslaving German teenagers and sending them to the French and British colonies in Africa, in South Asia, to work off the German war debt. And you read this stuff, and it's just ridiculous, but it's in the press. And this is what somebody is, opening up their morning newspaper, and they're reading about how, it was the federal government, it's of the central government was taking a certain percentage of Germans' teenagers and selling them into slavery to pay off these war debts that the country incurred. So anyway, and so when you talk about the resonances, yes, there are a lot of resonances with today. But as you said, history changes, times change, but people change, politics doesn't change.
You're talking about reading all of Hitler's speeches and reading the right-wing newspapers, and I couldn't help but think of another German, Nietzsche, who notably said, "He who hunts monsters must be careful lest he become a monster, and he who stares into the abyss must be careful because the abyss stares back." Did you find it happening to you?
It's funny when you are staring into an abyss when you're there. You really are. And when you're trying to understand, these are reprehensible people. And these actions are damnable. But it doesn't do any good to just write it off. When I tried to get underneath it and say, what was really going on here? Let's try to understand this. And you do find yourself in the abyss. You do have to be careful. I think there, I as a historian, I mean, you take a step back from the material, but it's trying to understand how we got there, rather than just writing this off. And Hitler, was, yeah, what was he a fanatic? He was a fanatic, but he, yeah, I used to say he was one of the few politicians who kept all those campaign promises, which he did. And he vowed to destroy democracy through democratic processes. And you look at this, and there's a whole group of, you know, we talked about those people. Well, there's a whole group of people around Hitler, including a man named Hans Frank, who was Hitler's private attorney, represented Hitler in more than 150 lawsuits, most of them for libel and slander in court. But Hans Frank also, he graduated at the top of his law class, the first lawyer trained, the first cadre of young German lawyers trained in a constitutional republic, in a democracy. So here you have a lawyer who understands the workings of democracy, the first German democracy, well, which meant he understood its strengths, but he also understood its weak points. And he's the one who ultimately designed Hitler's strategy to destroy democracy through democratic processes. And you know, Hans Frank ended up, when you hear that name, people who know history know that Hans Frank ended up hanging by the neck at Nuremberg for his role in the Holocaust. He was the governor general of Nazi-occupied Poland and is one of the most evil individuals out there, along with people like Himmler and Heydrich. This is the absolute heart of evil. But he was a guy, and this is when you stare into the abyss, when you're trying to see what's going on and you're watching this, this is where it actually gets almost a little scary, because how close are you getting to this blackness? Trying to understand it does not necessarily mean being sympathetic to it, but it's pretty toxic stuff sometimes, yes.
I thought it was really interesting how Hitler did. He insisted that he was going to take over the country, Germany, by legal means. He was at in the early days of the National Socialist Party. They had a lot of really violent people in the SS and the brown shirts, and they were ready. They were raring to get out there and kick butt. And there were a couple of times when, like, really, there are some really interesting points in this book where Rome, I think, was the one who was their leader. And he said, let's just go out there and take over. Let's just violently overthrow. And Hitler was very insistent. He said, I'm going to take over this country completely legally. And by the time I take over the government, I will hollow it out and it will already be ready for me to take over. And I thought that was fascinating, because it really, as I read, and I, this is something I got from your book that I didn't quite get from Schreiber's. Schreiber was very, is very consistent in saying that Hitler is a genius, and I thought, well, he's evil, and maybe an evil genius, but I think your book really points out how smart Hitler was to stick to his guns in certain ways. I'm going to take over the country legally, and I'm going to accept nothing less than absolute dictatorship. And I think that combination is what is really what you show gets him where he ended up, and ended up being such a terrifying proposition, you know, a really terrifying success. Talk about this character arc of certainty, and also too, complete doubt, because there are Hitler was not always on board, you know, with happiness. He was oftentimes fairly depressed, and at one point said, "If I am not made absolute dictator, I'll shoot myself in 3 minutes."
This, this issue of Hitler taking the legal path to power, we have to keep in mind the 1923 putsch. This was the famous Beer Hall putsch, where he actually attempted a violent overthrow of the government. It failed. Hitler ended up with a 5-year prison sentence, convicted of treason. And in fact, once again, when you go back to the press, when it looks like Hitler's going to be appointed chancellor, the newspapers are writing, how can a convicted felon be charged, be given control of a government that he tried to overthrow violently? This is going back to the 23 putsch. Well,
Well,
Hitler served his time. So you're hearing resonances, right?
oh yeah, absolutely. I just because one of the things I remember from reading the Scharwer book was that he periodically brought up the Beer Hall Putsch once he was in power and would celebrate the veterans of the Beer Hall Putsch, and I'm thinking, oh my God, this is
Well, the interesting thing is, this is what you were describing about Ernst Röhm, who was the head of of the stormtroopers. They were calling for the violent overthrow of the country. He led what was called the party radicals, who wanted violence. The other group was led by Hans Frank, the lawyer, who said, no, we will pursue the legal path to power. In fact, Hitler played it both ways. He followed the legal path to power, but he turned a blind eye to the street violence. So you had these stormtroopers killing people in the streets, you had them assaulting, you had them intimidating, and Hitler was just saying, well, these are just people who are a little out of control. These are my people, they're good people, they just get a little overexcited. I'm still committed to the legal path to power. And so you have Hitler kind of playing this both ways as he's going forward with it. Ultimately, with the ultimate goal, and this is with Hans Frank's guidance of destroying democracy through democratic means. I quote in the book, it's one of my favorite quotes. I think one of the most insightful quotes was by Joseph Goebbels, who's belonged to the party radicals, but he said, the big joke on democracy is that it gives its mortal enemies the means to its own destruction. And the Hitler took these in hand and they set about doing exactly that.
The new book by Timothy Ryback is Takeover: Hitler's Final Rise to Power. Thank you for joining me, Timothy. It's been a delight.
Phil, thank you for having me, Rick. And I love the fact that we got to talk about Bill Shire as well. It's wonderful. Thank you.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.